And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, July 3rd, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and with me is Nicole Nelson. Hey, Nicole.
Hey there, Barbara.
So fun to be here again together and talk about Curtis Sittenfeld's new novel. She is our guest for the entire hour and is the author of the best-selling novels American Wife, Prep, and The Man of My Dreams, which have been translated into 25 languages. Prep was chosen as one of the 10 best books of 2005 by the New York Times, and American Wife was chosen as one of the 10 best books of 2008 by Time, People, and Entertainment Weekly. Both were nominated for the UK's Orange Prize. Curtis's nonfiction has appeared in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, Salon, Slate, Glamour, and on public radio's This American Life. She's a graduate of Stanford and the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and her latest novel is Sisterland. Hi, Curtis.
Hi.
Great to have you on with us. I wonder if we could begin with you talking about a bit about Sisterland and how the book came about.
I'd be happy to. I live in St. Louis, Missouri. I moved here in 2007 because of my husband's job. And something that a lot of people don't know about Missouri is that what's now the Missouri Boot Heel was the site of the some of the biggest earthquakes in American history in 1811, 1812. I think they were not quite as strong as like the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, but they were very powerful. And so I knew I had that backstory sort of, you know, when I moved here, I knew all about that. But what happened, a friend of mine, after I'd been living here about a year, a friend of mine told me that in 1990, a self-described climatologist named Ivan Browning had predicted that on or around a certain day in December 1990, he said that there would be a massive earthquake. And there was this big, you know, outcry, like even though scientists really didn't think that the claim was credible, regular people took out earthquake insurance and kept their children home from school and put running shoes in the trunk of their car. And when my friend told me about this, I thought, oh, wouldn't that be a fascinating premise for a novel? But I decided, you know, instead of having a climatologist make a prediction, I'll have a psychic make a prediction, and I'll tell the story from the point of view not of the person making the prediction, but of someone close to her, in my case, her twin sister, who feels simultaneously really embarrassed by this kind of preposterous prediction and kind of believes it might happen and just feels very implicated by her close relationship to her twin. So that's the sort of long-winded general backstory of it.
That's great. And you spent some time in California. Have you ever been through an earthquake yourself?
I have. I've never been through a huge earthquake, but I've, you know, been through a few smaller ones.
Yeah. And also you mentioned that there's this element of the sisters having ESP, and there's a Ouija board that figures in the story. Have you had experiences with the Ouija board, or did you play around with it in writing the story?
I did not play around with it in writing the story. So I think, I was trying to remember this recently, but when I was maybe 12 or so, my family visited another family in the summer, and they had a Ouija board, and the girl and I played with it a lot, and then I think at some point someone said to me, oh, those are incredibly creepy, and there's reasons that you shouldn't play with them, and I had no idea. Like, it really hadn't occurred to me that it might be creepy. And then I think I felt this sort of like retroactive uneasiness, and I have not used a Ouija board since then.
When I was 13, we did the Ouija board. Or no, actually, it was maybe a little later or earlier than that at a pajama party, and it was scary. I related. Mm-hmm. I related. I mean, it was really kind of... Have you, Nicole?
I have played with them lots, just for fun.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah.
And the story is set in St. Louis, as you mentioned, and that's where you're currently living. Can you talk a little bit about setting? And, of course, it's important for this actual prediction, but you go way beyond that and relate it to life in the Midwest and in the suburbs. So can you talk about setting?
Well, yeah, basically something I did that makes the book, I don't know, maybe more or less strange is that even though it has this kind of kooky premise that it's about twin sisters, they're adults, and the main story takes place in the fall of 2009, and then there are flashbacks to their growing up, but I felt like, you know, the book sort of accepts that they're psychic, but in all other ways, the book is sort of conventionally realistic, and it's very much about motherhood and sisterhood and marriage and life in the suburbs. And I like when novels have a distinct sense of place. I like reading those kinds of novels. And so I kept it very grounded in real St. Louis. And so, like, the restaurants they go to are real restaurants, or, like, the playgrounds where they take their children are real playgrounds. And even, I mean, I ended up for the flashback scenes, because, of course, those took place long before I lived here. I did research where I toured the high school and the middle school where the twins would have attended. And, yeah, I mean, it was kind of, I've never lived in the place that I've set a novel and then when the novel has been published, and so I did feel this sense of really wanting to get it right and not, which I still, I mean, I'm sure I didn't get everything right, but I know that people, if I've made some glaring error in St. Louis, like, someone will come up to me in the grocery store and tell me.
Well, you know, regarding setting, when you're familiar with a place as you are, how do you get all the details in as if you've never seen it before, so that your readers who have never been there can see it and feel it? Because I think authors, I think especially as writers who are from a place, it's very easy to overlook maybe details that are, you know, common to us, but not so common to someone who's never been.
Right. Well, I think because in this situation, I'm a St. Louis outsider writing from the perspective of a St. Louis insider, so that might have been to my advantage in that I don't take the setting for granted, or I think, like, okay, how can you describe this? But a lot of it, the reader can just infer. And I sometimes, this is a strange comparison, but I sometimes think of, you know, the writer Junot Diaz, I admire a lot, and how he has a lot of Spanish in his writing. And I don't speak Spanish, but I can usually guess what he means. And so it's like, if I say in the book the characters have gone to such and such playground and you've never seen that playground, you know, you have seen other playgrounds. Like, you can kind of put it together in your own head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked how, I mean, I've been through St. Louis and the Arch and Botanical Gardens and all that, and and I like those touches, and I think at one point the characters are standing or lying on the ground under the arch, and it's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, actually, it's funny because that section, I, you know, describe how it's the night of their high school graduation, and they basically go downtown where they don't spend a lot of time, and smoke cigarettes under the arch and sort of talk about their future, how they want their lives to turn out. And I describe them in the first draft I wrote, I describe them basically like lying on the sidewalk under the arch. And then I thought, after I had written everything, I thought, okay, I need to do some fact-checking. And I got a friend of mine who's a writer to drive me around to the settings in the novel so that I could take notes and make sure they're correct. And we, at the arch, we get out, and I realize that under the arch is grass. And I had been there repeatedly before, but that's the kind of thing that if I hadn't corrected that, I think that readers in St. Louis would have been appalled.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine, and Nicole and I are talking with Curtis Sittenfeld. Her latest novel is Sisterland, published by Random House.
And you chose Kate as your point of view character, and, you know, she's one of two identical twins. I was curious if you considered, you know, having a dual narrative, or how did you settle upon your point of view for this book?
Well, again, for me, it was always interesting to think of not the person who sort of sets the plot in action, but the person close to the person who sets the plot in action. And, you know, with my last novel, American Wife, it's this fictional retelling of the life of Laura Bush. And it's a lot of the reason her life is interesting, not the only reason, but a lot of the reason, is her proximity to George W. Bush. And yet I had no desire to write a novel from the perspective of George W. Bush. It's almost like to me, that character is more interesting who's really close to the attention grabber or the scene stealer more than the scene stealer herself. And I didn't ever consider alternating perspectives. I also think, you know, with female authors and female characters, this whole issue of likability sometimes pops up. And I will say that I think the character of Vi, who's, you know, Kate's sister, the psychic Vi, it has a pretty strong personality, and a lot of readers have said she's so refreshing, and she's so funny, and she says whatever pops into her head, and I feel like if the whole book were from her perspective, people would find her kind of loathsome, and they would feel like she was driving them crazy. So it's kind of like she's more appealing in smaller doses, and then Kate, who's a more low-key person, although also flawed, I think can tell the story. She's not a totally reliable narrator, but she's less unreliable than her sister.
Yeah, and did you, because I, as someone who struggles with point of view, did you ever consider third person tied to Kate? I mean, I'm just curious if it just was obvious to you from the beginning it's going to be in first person, or did you not even consider that option?
I didn't consider third person. I mean, there's not a huge difference between closed third person and first person, but my preference is for first person. It just partly because, you know, a lot of people will say to me that my books seem autobiographical, but in fact they're not. Mm-hmm. And I feel like using first person helps me immerse myself in a character who is not me and really think about how does the world look from this person's eyes instead of how does this person go through the world? It's almost like putting on that person's, like, the costume of that person or climbing inside that person's skin.
That's interesting, though, that that you say you would rather do first person with a character that might not be entirely reliable, because I think a lot of writers might not want there to be any confusion that this isn't me.
Right,
you know?
right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, you know, I think I kind of threw that out the window with my first book where, you know, prep, like, it's like I definitely don't want people to think that I'm the main character in prep, and a lot of readers definitely do think I'm the main character in prep, and so it's sort of like, you know, it is what it is. I do what I think is best for the book and the story, and I try not to be really vain. And I think people, you know, it is a funny thing because sometimes I feel like I try so hard to make things realistic or to come up with dialogue that's plausible, and then the reader reaction can be not it's plausible, but, oh, it must be true, which is sort of, like, it's, you know, I try to take it as a compliment. It can be a little bit frustrating. But at the same time, I'm a big fan of Louis C.K. and, you know, mm-hmm. the show Louis. And there would be these parts of Louis where I'll think that must have happened to him. Like, he must be borrowing that from his own life or, you know, from his interaction with his children and having the actresses who play his children on the show say the dialogue that his daughters have really said. And, again, like, I'm doing to him what other people, I think, do to me. But it's just, it's really a reflection of the fact that I just think this is so convincing. This is so yeah. authentic. How could it not be real?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Do you, or have you gone through a phase of struggling at all with self-censorship? I heard that you seriously black out the sex scenes in your novels before you give copies to your mom.
That's true. But again, that's kind of, that's from the other side of things. You know, that's like, that's not exactly, it's like retro, you know, redacting more than self-censorship, which I, you know, the distinction is somewhat fine between those. But there's a writer named Sarah Dunn who, I read an interview with her one time, and she basically said that she wrote this book, and I think any time she felt like she was writing something that she was, like, a little nervous about, or I don't know whether it would be she was borrowing something from someone she knew or she was, you know, writing something that seemed potentially embarrassing to her, she would write it down on a piece of paper in a coffee can and then just kind of set it to the side. And then after she finished the book, she drove cross-country, lost the coffee can, and I think, like, that was that. But I do feel like you can't censor yourself while you're writing. I mean, there's so many things that you can't do while you're writing if you want to finish a manuscript. Like, you can't stop at every imperfect sentence because you're going to write, you know, many, many, many imperfect sentences, and you just kind of keep going, and then you go back and fix them. Like, the people I know who don't finish novels are the ones who only allow themselves to write beautiful sentences before they go on to the next beautiful sentence. And I think that it's a similar thing to feel like, what am I revealing about myself when I write this? You sort of can't think of yourself while you're writing. And I think one of the great things for me about writing is that on a good day, I lose awareness of myself, which is enjoyable for me.
Well, that's interesting, too, what you just said about, you know, the people who don't finish novels, because something I've been thinking a lot about lately is this notion of perfectionism and how we, you know, we writers, or a lot of writers, feel that, yeah, before they put something out there, it has to be perfect, whatever that means. And it seems that if you do that, you're going to have a lot of unpublished books on the shelf because none of them will be good.
Right, right, right. I mean, and I feel like I know people who I think are very talented who will, you know, do things like finish an entire draft of a novel and then just sort of put it away because they'll think, you know, it's just not good enough to be my first novel, or, like, I really want to make a splash because, you know, I know that the first novel sort of matters disproportionately. And it's just kind of like, I don't know, you can't, we are not perfect. Like, I think that I've accepted, and I don't think this idea is original to me, but that like, any novel is inherently imperfect because it's created by a person, and that's okay, you know? That's like, I guess in a best-case scenario, the ways that it's imperfect are interesting or, like, cause you to think about the choices that the writer made, but no matter what, I mean, there's very few books that, like, every reader thinks, okay, everything is in place just the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You had a funny quote in the New York Daily News, and you said, "I have a tendency to write novels that I myself wouldn't read if I hadn't written them." And that kind of stuck with me, and I thought, you know, why is that striking me? And I thought that it just flies in the face of the conventional advice you get to read the book that, or to write the book that you want to have read or to read. And so why do you write if it's not for that?
Well, I think that actually, if this is possible, both those things are true. Like, I definitely think that essentially I am my own demographic, and I think I would enjoy the books that I've written if I read them. If someone else had written them and someone said, but I think the idea of some of them might be off-putting to me. So it's like, if you said, oh, it's, well, for one thing, you know, my first book prep is about boarding school. So if you said there's this book about boarding school, and I would think, I went to boarding school, you know, like, oh, there's another boarding school novel. Who needs one of those? Or, like, my book about Laura Bush, I would think, that's kind of weird that, like, she's a real person, but this is a novel, and the main character is, like, kind of based on her, but kind of not based on her, and has a different name, and there's this weird blurring between fact and fiction. And so I just think that it's almost like the premise of them might deter me, even though I think I would enjoy them page by page as a reader. Does that distinction make sense?
It does. I'm going to have to sit with it longer, but I mean, I like it a lot. So, and in reviews, people talk about your facility with dialogue, and that's been the case since prep, and, you know, it's there with Sisterland as well. So how do you do it?
Well, I just write a scene, and, you know, tension in a scene never hurts in terms of making dialogue more interesting, but I write it, and then I sort of ask myself if it works or not, or if I've pulled it off or not. And if I haven't, then I rewrite it. And then, like, I ask myself again if it works that time. And if it still doesn't, then I rewrite it. I mean, there's definitely, I write scenes where I'm pretty much embarrassed for myself at how terrible the dialogue is. And then I just kind of try to improve it and improve it. Or, like, there's this kind of sort of cutesy dialogue that I really don't like that, I sometimes do it myself. I see it in other people. Like, it just, it doesn't, it sounds like really, like, B or C level sitcom banter. And I fall into that trap, but I just try to correct it and make it better as I revise.
Do you read aloud? Do you read your stuff aloud?
Yes.
At what point?
In fact, especially the further I get in the writing process, and so, like, the last few times I'll read my books out loud in their entirety, and there's this strange period in my life when, like, you could probably read any sentence to me in the book, and I could tell you what sentence comes next. But thank goodness, that's only true for one book at a time. And so then that book passes out of my head, and another one comes in. But, yeah, it takes me, like, sometimes people will say, like, I read your book, you know, I started it last night, and then I stayed until 2 in the morning to finish it. And I'll think, oh, my God, it takes me, like, 10 days to read my book because at the end I'm reading it out loud.
Yeah, but it helps. I mean, when you see it on the page or read it on the screen, when you're not speaking it, so many things just sort of kind of fly by that you don't notice.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Your books have great titles, too. And so, Sisterland, at what point in the project did you settle on that title?
It was relatively late, actually. And this happened with prep. It didn't happen with American Wife, but there's probably, like, 100 alternate titles for this. And then this is the one where I liked it, my agent liked it, my editor liked it, my British editor liked it. Like, because some of the other ones, like, one, at one point, I thought it should be called The Future Will Find Us, which even saying this out loud is a little bit garbled. And my agent liked it, and my editor did not like it, and she thought it sounded like science fiction. So there's all these, and I'm trying to think of, like, I mean, and some of them were also almost more punny based on the earthquake, like aftershocks or fault lines, and then one morning I just woke up and I thought, Sisterland.
Yeah. We're talking to Curtis Sittenfeld, author of Sisterland. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Curtis Sittenfeld will stay with us for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby. Don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
I lost my mojo.
You lost it?
I lost it.
Where'd it go?
I don't know, but I found it. I found it on Writers on Writing.
Writers on Writing?
Wednesday mornings at 9. 9 a.m. in the morning.
With Barbara DeMarco Barrett and Marie Stone?
That's them.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. This show will join the others on the podcast, and you can find that by either going to writersonwriting.blogspot.com, which is where we keep the archive of shows, or penonfire.com, where you will find this show and others, and you'll find other sorts of events going on around Orange County, typically, California, Southern California here. July 18th, we have Chris Bojalian coming in for the Pen on Fire speaker series. And if you want to know more about that event, go to penonfire.com and click on speaker series.
And we're back with Curtis Sittenfeld, author of Sisterland. Curtis, you captured the details so well. In this case of motherhood and the time period of the 80s and the flashback, there's a quote early on with Kate and her daughter, and she says, "How flattering motherhood was when they weren't smearing food on my clothes or sneezing into my mouth." And I had to stop there and have a moment because it brought back the sneezes that went into my mouth. And so do you keep a notebook, or how do you amass all those details?
Well, you know, I don't think I've ever had to write down being having my mouth sneezed into to remember it. It's like pretty vivid. I have two children. They're 2 and 4, and so they are older than the children in the book. But you know, I think there are certain universals of parenthood, and I don't know. I mean, again, I think that I still do have very young children. One of the things I felt about the parenting details in the book was that I wanted them to be in the service of the story and the plot, and I didn't want to use the book as a vehicle for sort of telling cute stories about my own children. So there are, like, observations about parenthood or sort of details that are supposed to be realistic, but they're not, again, it's not like supposed to be the equivalent of a Facebook posting for me that's like, you know, look at the hilarious thing that my daughter did at breakfast.
You know, speaking of Facebook, I suppose we can't let a show go by without saying a few words at least about social media and marketing and platform and all of that. And what's your relationship with marketing and publicity or social media? I mean, do you feel it necessary or desirable to be involved in that way? And I mean, a lot of authors do and a lot of authors don't. How do you feel?
I would say that it's a good question and it's a complicated question. I have not been much of a participant in social media, and I have a Twitter account, but I've never tweeted, and I don't really, from time to time I look at other people's tweets, but not on a daily basis or even a weekly basis. And in terms of, I mean, I probably get on Facebook. I was a pretty late joiner to Facebook, and I probably get on about once every 6 weeks, which essentially defeats the purpose of being on it. And it's not like snobbiness or disdain on my part. It's more that, for me, it feels like an either-or choice, where it's like I can write fiction or I can be a social media presence, but I don't think I can do both, especially when my children are so young.
Mm-hmm.
And truthfully, I think that probably any publisher, including my own, which is Random House, would be happy to have an author be a very, you know, visible social media presence if it feels authentic or natural to that author. I think that there is some idea that you kind of can't fake it, and it's almost like if I had never tweeted and then sent out 20 tweets being like, Sisterland, pub date, June 25th, you know, $27. I think that would give off kind of a bad smell to people. But at the same time, I think the reality is, I don't know if I would say I put myself at a disadvantage not being a social media presence, but I think I'd probably have bigger turnouts at my readings if I were one, or... You know, I don't know, maybe I would have better sales. I mean, the other thing is that I'm in a position, which I certainly don't take for granted, where I have a lot of support from my publisher. I feel like my publicists do a really great job, and I don't think anyone kind of observing my career would shed any tears over, like, my lack of exposure or my sales. You know, could things be taken to another level, like, probably. Do I have the appropriate personality for that? I don't know that I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's different pressures depending on where you are in your career. If you're a new author, first novel, first nonfiction, narrative, memoir, whatever, then there's probably more pressure to get out there as opposed to, you know, your third or fourth or fifth novel and already having sort of a readership.
Right, right, right. But and again, it's like, you know, understand that I have two young children. Like, if I said to them, would you rather that I send out, you know, 7 tweets a day, or would you rather that I turn in my novel? I'd like to think that they would have said, we'd rather you turn in your novel, but
yeah.
Maybe I should ask.
When you were writing your novel, are you an outliner?
Yes.
Oh,
traditional outline, do you do like a linear sort of outline, or do you do something like, you know, I don't know, clustering or mind mapping or plot boards or anything like that?
I do pretty traditional outlining. I don't do very elaborate outlines in the sense that, so my final book is 400 pages, and my outline for it was probably 3 typed pages, where, you know, there are 19 chapters, and so I probably thought, this is what I want to achieve in each chapter, this is how I want to move things forward. And so one sentence in an outline could correspond to like 20 or 30 pages of scenes in the book. So it's not like every gesture is mapped out, but I do like to have a general sense of where I'm going.
So maybe not every gesture, but how about things like flashbacks and peeks forward? Do you have those placed ahead of time, or do you just write those as you're, you know, loosely following your outline?
I think some combination. And you're right that I do loosely follow it. Like, if you looked at the first draft of my outline and compared it to the finished book, there would definitely be some sort of unrecognizable spots where, you know, I had ideas for plots that completely didn't come to fruition, or I didn't have ideas early on for things that later became important parts of the plot. I mean, I had a writing teacher once, Chris Offit, who, you know, writes everything, like stories, you know, memoir, he's written for TV, but any...
I don't know. She's, we can't hear you, Curtis. I don't know what happened.
Oh
there you are.
Oh, no.
Okay,
sorry about
you're
that.
Back.
You can hear me now?
Yeah, you're back.
Okay, sorry about that. So, my teacher, Chris Offit, would say that the first 10 pages of any story is throat clearing, and that you're kind of figuring out what you're doing before you're really doing it, and I agree with it. Like, I see that in my own writing, where I feel like, you know, especially there was at one point I had my second child while writing this book, And I felt like, even though this isn't, usually I let myself be pretty messy and just write a complete first draft, but with this one, because of having the baby, I wrote 75 pages, and I wanted to get them pretty clean so that it wouldn't be intimidating to re-enter them after having the baby, you know, after several months had passed. And so I kind of, like, you know, got them into a state where other people could read them, and I sent them to my editor and my agent, partly because, in all honesty, I got a one-year extension for writing this book, and I wanted to sort of say, like, there are some pieces of paper that exist, and it's not just, like, you know, this idea in my head. So anyway, so I clean up these 75 pages. I felt pretty good about them. And then subsequently, like, you know, 6 months later, or it was probably... It was probably more like 5 months from the time that I sent them to the time I went back to the writing after having my daughter. And I thought they were really pretty bad when I went back to them, which in a way is almost a relief because it means you have some distance from the material and you're not so blind to its flaws. And then it's discouraging because you still have to make it better, but it's encouraging that you know you have some sense of what to do to improve it.
Yeah. You mentioned your teacher who wrote in a lot of different formats, and I know you've written a lot of journalism for places like Slate, the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, but I haven't seen much of your short fiction. What's your relationship like with short stories?
Well, I have a fondness for short stories. I mean, I like reading them when they're done well. My favorite writer is Alice Munro, who only writes short stories. Well, I guess I just announced her retirement at the age of 81, but, you know, she has written only short stories, not novels. So I am certainly a fan of short stories, and I went through an MFA program. I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and that's basically how most writers train themselves. You know, instead of, you don't go from writing nothing to writing a novel, like you write a lot of short stories. So I have ideas for stories, and I have great fondness for short stories. It happens that now I spend more of my life writing novels, and partly that's just, I mean, there are sort of practical reasons I do that, like I sign contracts with a publishing house to write novels, and I just don't, I'm not a clever enough manager of my own time to have extra time to work on stuff that, you know, like if I write an essay for the New York Times, that might take a few days, and then I turn it in, and maybe they want some revisions or some editing, and that might take a few more days. But to write a short story, I feel like would take probably at least a month, and I just feel like, you know, I'm on deadline for my novels, and that's where my focus is. And so, but I would love to write a short story collection at some point.
You know, speaking of writing essays for the New York Times or writing shorter pieces, I think I read that you won a 17 magazine contest when you were something like 16 or 17, and then didn't publish again for many years, and had to deal with rejections before your work started getting published. I wonder, well, first of all, if that's all true, and then when you started getting published again, was it with shorter pieces like essays, or did you go straight into novel writing and then fit the essays in wherever and whenever?
Okay, so that is mostly accurate, everything you're saying. So I did win 17 fiction contest. It was like 3 days before my 17th birthday, appropriately enough. So it was right before I started my senior year in high school. And then I had a few things published, like a few other short stories. I had another story in 17. I had a story in Ms. Magazine. But I never had a story, to this day, I've never had a story, like, in the New Yorker or the Paris Review. Oh, I had a story in the Mississippi Review, obviously a literary magazine. So, but it wasn't, I was not a presence in literary magazines. And then, you know, Prep came out when I was 29. So 12 years had passed between my winning the 17 fiction contest and my you know, my first novel coming out, which, again, it's to be 29 and have your first novel come out, it's not like you're still very much on the young side of things, but it also was, like, I had been writing all that time, and so yeah, I mean, that's kind of how things proceeded for me. I mean, when I graduated from college, my first real job was, well, actually, the summer I graduated, I was an intern at the Charlotte Observer in North Carolina, so I was a daily assignment reporter, which was a really good experience for me and taught me certain professional skills, and was this sort of, there was strong evidence that I was not meant to be a general assignment daily reporter. Like, I just didn't, I was not assertive enough in a lot of ways, even though doing it made me more assertive. And then I went and worked at a business magazine called Fast Company that was then in Boston. And my editors were wonderful. I mean, they were, like, at my wedding, you know, several years later. But they understood that I did not have a business background, and so they would give me the kind of kooky, colorful stories, and I would write lots of profiles of people. Like, it would be like a creativity consultant or teenagers who are actually working for Microsoft, or, you know, just like the human interest stories and not the nitty-gritty, like, economic stories. And so I, you know, have had one foot or, like, a few toes in journalism all along. And again, because of having children, I don't, like, there's times when I get invitations to write freelance pieces, and I just feel like I can't because of time. And then there's other freelance assignments where it's like, I should say no because of time, but then I'm so irresistibly curious that I do it anyway. And something that I think non-writers don't always realize is that there's a big distinction between a piece of journalism that you do interviews for and a piece of journalism that you just kind of write based on the ideas in your head. And it's much more work to go out and interview people, but it's also, for me, it's more interesting. You know, it's like I'm familiar with the thoughts in my head, but it's kind of fun to go interview someone and step into their world.
Yeah. We're talking to Curtis Sittenfeld, author of Sisterland. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. And with your work, at what point do you seek out feedback? Do you have a writing group, or do you just send drafts straight to your editor? Or
So this has changed for me over time. When I wrote Prep, it has 8 chapters, and I showed those chapters as soon as I was finished with them, which was not, I didn't write them in chronological order, but I showed them. I started the book in grad school, so I showed it to my grad school classmates, and then after I finished grad school, I showed it to my writer friends as soon as I finished one. And with my other, like, the older I've gotten and the more I'm not around other writers on a daily basis, the less often I show things. And, you know, I mentioned sending a 75-page sort of beginning to Sisterland to my agent and editor, and that was all I showed them until I sent the whole thing. Because especially with a novel, like, you know, different novels are written in different ways, and Prep was more episodic, and so you could read a chapter and evaluate it, you know, sort of by itself, whereas with Sisterland, all the chapters are so interconnected that I don't think they could be evaluated except as a whole.
Yeah, and I noticed there, in Sisterland, it felt like there were a lot more shorter, like, chunks than in Prep, which was had longer passages, it seemed.
Yeah, I think that is true. I mean, I think it's the difference between, you know, actually the books are about the same length, but one has 8 chapters and one has 19 chapters, so obviously the one with 8 chapters, each chapter is, you know, about twice as long as the chapters in Sisterland.
With Prep, I heard at one point that there's a screenplay in existence by Noah Baumbach. Is there any forward movement on that project, or is that not?
There is a screenplay in existence by Noah Baumbach. There is not forward movement on it. So, you know, it's one of those things where, and actually, American Wife has been optioned. It's been, you know, under option. I don't even know if I'm saying you guys are the ones in Southern California, so I'm using the terminology correctly. But since it came out, it's been optioned. The options have expired for Prep, but and then this one I think is about to be optioned. Actually, potentially for TV rather than for a feature. But it's one of those things where I don't control it at all, which is kind of a relief. Like, I think it'd be really fun if one of my books becomes a movie or a TV show, but there's nothing I can do to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was curious, sort of backing up just a little bit, I am curious if you are a one-project writer or if you jump around and go to where the heat is. You know, I mean, do the essays, for instance, come in when you're kind of in a novel project and don't quite know what comes next, or with novels? Because I noticed in Sisterland that you, you know, just when things are or maybe quieting down a little bit in the plot, you throw in a twist or something new happens. So anyway, I guess it's a two-part question. Are you a one-project writer? And then following up on that, talk a little bit about keeping things moving in your books.
Well, to answer the first question, I think I try to be a one-project writer. I mean, the issue is, if that project is a novel and it's going to take several years, the reality is that I'm probably going to want to write an essay or two or five somewhere along the way of working on the novel, and I feel like you know, that's fine. Like, it's I think that as writers we can develop momentum by writing every day and really immersing ourselves in the subject matter that we've chosen, and interrupting myself, it's not really good for the novel, but sometimes something happens, like there's some timely issue, and I think, like, I have something to say about this, or, you know, something like really tempting falls in my lap, and I just can't say no to it. So, although I do actually try to say no to a lot of things, but, and it's also, I mean, even as I hear myself say that, like there was a time when I supported myself as a freelancer after I finished graduate school and before I had a novel published, and I feel like I was sort of throwing myself at magazines with, like, a pretty low rate of success, and then after Prep came out, some of these same magazines would approach me and say, like, we'd love to have you write, and it was almost like, by that point, I felt too busy, and I had another novel contract. So it's, I mean, as in life, there's many situations where, like, you get the thing you want after you've kind of stopped wanting it, right? Or, like you don't get it exactly when you want it or in the way that you want it. But anyway, in terms of freelancing, like, I like to do it. I like to work with magazine and newspaper editors because they tend to be really smart, and it can be fun to get, you know, sometimes I get negative feedback, sometimes I get positive feedback for my freelance pieces, but sometimes it's fun to, like, have that little mini interaction, whereas, you know, again, I haven't had a novel come out for 5 years, so it just feels like, like, it's almost like everyone around you has to take it on faith that you're actually working and doing something, because there's not that much evidence to suggest that you are.
Mm-hmm. And then in your books, how do you keep things moving? You know, because in Sisterland, really, there was sort of one twist after another to the end, which was a major twist. And so, you know, is that all in your outline when you are thinking out the book, or Are you, when you're writing, do you come to a point where you go, you know, nothing's happened in a while, I have to make something happen, what should I make happen?
Well, I want the twist to seem organic. Like, there's this phrase that's attributed to Flannery O'Connor, I'm not sure if she's the one who really said it, but that events should seem surprising yet inevitable, and I feel like, you know, that's my goal, that I want this something to happen that it's like, I didn't see that coming, and yet it completely makes sense. It's totally convincing. How could anything else have happened? But I do feel like, you know, people read novels for different reasons, but one of the major reasons is to be entertained. And so I think, you know, it's part of my job to have plot twists. It's mm-hmm. like I'm not writing diary entries. I'm writing novels that people are going to read, and they want things to happen, and, you know, they don't want, like, to see a character just, like, washing dishes for 300 pages or something.
So there are a few years that seem to come between your novels, and yet I've heard wind of a couple different projects you have coming up. Can you talk about your future projects?
Yeah, well, so this is something that has sort of fell out of the blue, and as I was saying before, it's one of those things that I just couldn't resist. But so the British HarperCollins, the publisher, has embarked on this project where they're commissioning six writers to retell each of Jane Austen's six novels. And the novels are all supposed to be set in the present, but otherwise the publisher is, you know, kind of saying, do whatever you want. And they approached me, this is maybe a year and a half ago, and they said, would you like to rewrite or, you know, write a version of Pride and Prejudice? And I feel like when someone comes to you and asks you that, like, what can you say except, like, sure, I'd be delighted to. So it's not something that I think I would have initiated on my own, but I just thought, oh, that sounds like so much fun. So that will be my next book.
That sounds great. And so we're running down on our time here, but before we let you go, do you have any advice to the writers out there?
Oh, my God. I know, like, any advice on any subject.
Well, no. On writing, on, you know, probably more for novelists who may be kind of struggling through a draft or the second draft or the third draft even, and are wondering what to do. What can we tell them?
Well, I would say, I mean, I think, you know, think about why you do it and enjoy the process of writing, even though it can be challenging, because there's no reason to do it if you don't enjoy it. You know, like, it's so unlikely to result in, like, great wealth or whatever the ideal is. But it's like, I think, like, remember and appreciate that it can be this really satisfying, engaging mental challenge, and this thing that you like to do, whether or not you get published, whether or not other people approve of your work. So that's one thing I would say. And then this is almost like opposite conflicting advice, but I would say at the same time, if your goal is to get published, and I think it's totally legitimate to write for yourself and not try to get published, but if you are trying to get published, you know, remember that you have readers, and that just because something is kind of dear to you or, like, reflects your vision doesn't necessarily mean that it will speak to readers.
Mm, that's a good one.
Well, thanks, Curtis. It was great to have you on.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Curtis Sittenfeld. Her book is Sisterland, and that was fun. I actually stayed up till probably 1:30 in the morning finishing her book last night, and Travis came out at one point and went, are you going to bed? Don't you have to get up early? I'm like, I have to finish the book.
It really sucked me in, too. I read it a short span.
Yeah, I'm interested in her other books. I'm interested in Prep, especially, I think. Anyway, this has been fun, and you've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. Visit penonfire.com if you want more info on the show, who's coming up, or the Pen on Fire speaker series. And so, until next week, we will see you then. Stay in the chair, get some writing done, and have a great holiday.